Hare Krishna. So welcome to today's seminar on the philosophy of transcendence for this Ekadasi day. And I would like to begin by going over some points that were raised yesterday, or even one other point besides that too. Four things I've written down here, most of which came up yesterday, and I thought about them, so now I have something more to say. So first of all, Gaur Hari Prabhu, yes, there you are. You raised a question which came in your mind after hearing a seminar from Bhakti Vidyapurna Maharaj. Again, I'm not going to address anything said in that seminar because I would have to hear it myself and talk with Maharaj before commenting on anything he said. But your concern seemed to be the question of the emotions' effect on the intellect, and is there a difference in this effect between men and women? Is that
something like that?
Something like that. Okay. Well, that's as far as I'm going to go in my comment on this. So the first thing I want to refer you to is Srila Prabhupada's introduction to the Nectar of Devotion. There you see it's very clear that in Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, and also the other day I was reading from this Brahman and Vaishnava by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and he makes the same point there. So it is a essential principle to Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy that behind everything in human affairs, whether we're speaking of activity or thought, behind everything there is rasa, there is taste. In his introduction to Nectar Devotion, Srila Prabhupada says whatever anyone is doing in their life, any occupation, any situation that they have in life, they're doing that because they're deriving from that activity, that state of being, a taste, which they find for themselves enjoyable. So, taste is an affair of the emotions. We taste, we relish, we experience happiness or pleasure, whatever, through satisfaction. This is through the affective aspect of the mind, the emotional aspect of the mind. So, in this way, it can't be argued that above thoughts and above activities, emotions are the determining factor of what we're thinking and what we're doing. Now, as far as the question of men and women and how that's going on in them, because what you seem to be saying is that perhaps men are able to separate their emotions from their thoughts, and women don't do that.
That's the theory. I mean, there's this book, the famous book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus.
Yeah, right. Well, personally, I really hold these kind of books in very little regard. I might say less than little regard, negative regard. So, what I would say is that in some respects, most men in some respects, can be seen to emote differently from most women, in some respects. I mean, we're all human beings, men and women, so in many, I would say most respects, the emotional states are similar, stimulated by similar reasons. But in some respects, a difference can be seen. And for example, I think that men are more apt to become excited about philosophy than women are. I think that that's a valid observation. But the driving force that makes men interested in philosophy is also a taste, an emotional state. And that is really, if there's a title of a book, which is a book on, yes, it's a abstract, you know, book on a very abstract subject about theories of cosmology. You know, modern theories of what the universe is like from the standpoint of astrophysics, quantum physics, etc., etc., etc. The name of the book is The Fire in the Equations. You see? Now, the equations, these are the mathematical formulas by which they try to explain everything, but there's a fire behind them. There's an urge to understand, to comprehend this vast universe, which is driving on these theoreticians in their very abstract, you know, floating around in mental plane activity. There's still a taste, which is making that relishable for them. So fire, what is it? It means passion. They're passionate. Yeah, that book was written by a woman, by the way. Kitty Ferguson. There have been some women philosophers, actually. See, you asked me that yesterday. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there's Gargi Vachavnavi. Yes, Vachavnavi. It means that she's the daughter of Vachavna. So she's a Brahmani. She's a lady Brahmana. And in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is, again, I mentioned before, the Mayavadi just love this Upanishad because to them it's like the real, you know, essence of Advaita doctrine. So it's supposedly very, very intellectual and very, you know, difficult to penetrate. And the main setting of this Upanishad is a Sammelan, a gathering of saints and sages. And Yajñavalkya Muni is the main speaker. He's answering their questions. And it's interesting when you read that, you see different stages of men. And then there's this Gargi, there's this woman there also, this lady is there. And she actually puts the most penetrating questions to Yajñavalkya. She is the one who asks such questions that Yajñavalkya warns her, now this is the end of the inquiry. Because she was going so far into questions of transcendence. What is beyond, what is beyond, what is beyond. So he warned her, you see, now we're going into a realm which is not appropriate to discuss here. So please don't ask any further. And then he said, otherwise your head will explode. So then she turned to the other sages and she said to them, you will never be able to defeat him. I declare this. He, among all of you, is the one who is most advanced in knowledge. So this is, it's like this lady, Gargi, she is the one who gives the judgment as to who's who in this assembly. That's very interesting. And Baladeva Vidyabhushan, in his Govinda Basik commentary, he mentions her and says that she is a Nitya Siddha Vaishnavi. He gives her as an example of Nirapeksha, means always seeing Krishna. Apeksha means the eyes. Nira means never seeing anything separate from the Lord. So always absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So she is, from the Vedas, one example. And The guru of Socrates was a woman, Diotima. And Sankaracharya, he defeated a great, in the Sankara Vijay, he debates with two Karma Mimamsa philosophers. And one whose name I can't, the other one was Madana Mishra, I think, and the other one, name escapes me. So I think it was this other one. He debated him and defeated him. But his wife was attending the discussion. And after her husband was defeated, she said, "Now you have to defeat me." And she was actually the incarnation of Saraswati. And she said, "I want to discuss the Kama Shastra." You know, like Kama Sutra, those kind of scriptures. And Shankaracharya said, "Well, you see, I'm a sannyasi, and before that I was a Brahmin. I took sannyas when I was 7 years old, so I don't know anything about Kama Shastra." And she said, "Well, if you want to consider, if you want to walk out of here considering that you defeated anyone, you have to discuss this with me. Otherwise, since I'm the better half of my husband, you may think you've defeated him, but you haven't defeated me, so you haven't defeated him either." So that's when Shankaracharya, he resorted to going into mystic trance. He went into a cave and left his body and projected his body out, and projected his subtle body out, rather. And he saw that there was a king who was leaving his body, dying. So as that soul left, he entered. And it appeared to all the people around that the king had a remarkable recovery. But it was Shankaracharya inside the body of the king. So he stayed within that king's body for 3 months and learned all the Kama Shastra. Because a king is supposed to know these things, because he has generally more than one wife, and every wife has so many maidservants, which the king also has access to. So after 3 months, then he returned and he talked with this lady about Kama Shastra, and she was satisfied and said, "Okay, we accept that you are the foremost philosopher now." So there are some in history outstanding. Here we have some more Vyavahar business. Do we? No? Yes. But generally we see it's just the psychological nature. That's one difference. I say generally, it's not true in every case. And I always think that in discussing these issues, we have to first of all, especially if we're discussing persons, we have to look at them as individuals rather than immediately put them into categories, because in that way we may make a mistake about a person. But it is a general fact that when it comes to philosophy, women don't have that rasa that men have for philosophy. And therefore, men can go deeper into it. They are able to think more about that, in general. Now, there are certainly many men who are slugs and dullards of the first degree. So, but this is a general truth. Srila Prabhupada definitely affirms that. So I wanted to say that. As I said, that's not a comment on anything you may have heard from Bhaktivedanta Purana. I don't know what he said. I wasn't there. But you have provoked this response from me. So this is what I'm going to say. And then about, there was a question about psychological diseases. So that the symptoms at least seem to be reduced or remedied by drugs. So I want to note that different drugs are endowed with different potencies of the modes of material nature. There are drugs that are called depressants, So obviously they're endowed with the potency of the tamoguna. You take them and you want to sleep, you see, or you just feel very dull and don't have no energy to move around. There are other drugs called stimulants, and they make one very energetic, running around, talking like a madman, doing many things at once. So obviously, such drugs are endowed by the Shakti of Rajoguna. I don't know about any... Well, Somarasa maybe is a Sattva-guna drug. Prabhupada said, yeah, he said the so-called sadhus take ganja.
Aids their meditation, helps to still the mind.
Well, Prabhupada once said they take it as the solution to their sex desire. See, instead of breaking one regulative principle, you break another. And in a conversation with Chattubhai Patel at Juhu, Prabhupada was saying that the hippies in America, they simply learned this ganja smoking from the so-called sadhus in India, and he cited Allen Ginsberg as an example. He came to India in 1960 and moved among these type of babajis with their chillums and their mantras to Lord Shiva, bum bolo bum and all that they chant when they puff. So Prabhupada said the whole stimulus for the hippie movement came from India. And Mr. Patel objected very strenuously. He didn't like this. And then Prabhupada pointed out, that is because you are thinking that this smoking marijuana is also sadhana, isn't it? Oh, what's it? Isn't it? He said, well, they are also sadhus, Swamiji. And then Prabhupada was turning to his disciples. Just see. As I said, Mr. Patel, he was a demi-Vaishnava or something, some Vaishnava para, isn't that the word?
Vaishnava bhas.
Bhas. Mixture. He.
Vaishnava praya.
Vaishnava praya. Okay.
Vaishnava bandhu.
He knew the whole Gita. He could recite the Gita from memory, but he had a, you know, this type of, it's reflexive, you know, like you hit your knee and the knee kicks out. This reflexive Hindu respect for any sadhu, you know, Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, all are sadhus. The ones who smoke chillum, they're also sadhu. So Prabhupada pointed out the defect of this. Anyway, so the point I'm trying to make is that what is going on in the mind at all times, at least in the materialistic mind, it is simply being moved by the three modes of material nature. You see, sometimes the mind is in the state of tamogun, sometimes rajogun, sometimes sattvagun. So these drugs are able to impose upon the mind a particular guna and hold the mind under that guna. So someone who's a little too speedy, mind racing, this is one symptom of mental disturbance. The mind is racing and one's activities are very agitated and one's speech is very jumbled up. And so if one takes a certain tamasic drug, then all of that will be covered and pushed down. But my point is the root cause of that problem is still there. It's just masked by the imposition of tamoguna. So, you see, if we're looking at things, this is my warning to you. We have to understand things not externally. This is the materialistic mind. It's always resorting to, you know, the so-called concrete physical explanation for things, but actually what's going on in this world is all subtle. This world, whatever is happening, Sri Krishna says in Gita, is because of the modes of nature. What did we learn yesterday? I hope we learned this yesterday, that the modes of material nature, they are based in consciousness. We learned about the whole evolutive creation as coming out of these modes of nature. The false ego, the initial covering of consciousness, manifesting three types of ego, vaikari, taijasa, and the other one, I forgot just now. But anyway, these are the three modes. And so it's from out of this that this physical world is manifesting. Okay, then, oh yes, then someone, then about the question about these diseases, these mental diseases themselves, and can they be cured by chanting Hare Krishna, or, you know, we see devotees, this is a concern, devotees are having these mental diseases, and if they only chant Hare Krishna, they're still mad, and they have to take these drugs, and why is that? So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in the Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita, when he's speaking of the effects of pap, of sinfulness, on the living entity, one of the items that he mentions is mental disease. This is a reaction to sin. This is a reaction to very serious sin. Like in the Vedas, they have these categories, atipap, mahapap, very serious kinds of sin. So, the manifest reaction of such severe sinfulness, one of them, is mental disease. So, Lochan Das Thakur, Somsari Madhya Rohili Podia, Sepodi Nahilo Ash, Apana Karama, Bunjia Shamana. Shamana, correct me if I'm wrong, this is referring to Yamaraj. Yes. So Srila Prabhupada translates these lines that Lochan Das Thakur is addressing his mind. That my mind does not have attraction for the lotus feet of Sri Sri Gaurdatai. So that means the mind is crazy. From transcendental point of view, that means mad. The mind does not have attraction to the lotus feet of Sri Sri Gaurdatai, and Lochan Das says this must be because I am being punished by Yamaraj. So I think this is the way to understand why it is that we see persons are attracted to the Krishna consciousness movement. They enter the Krishna consciousness movement. They want to be devotees, but they bring with them some very serious mental problem. And I would surmise this must be the result of some aparad, some sin previously. And it is not easy for them to shake that off, even when they chant Hare Krishna. So, what the cure is, that's another thing. Don't ask me. These are specific cases, and ultimately the cure must be Krishna's mercy, since the disease is imposed in that way as a reaction to some severe sin or aparad, then only Krishna can lift this. And then finally, this is from the talk day before yesterday I gave on His Holiness Sridhar Maharaj. Just a little point that, remember, we were talking about that dog of Sri Krishna Kapoor, and then Maharaj and I were kind of trying to remember when that was that Srila Prabhupada was saying, that dog. And I was supposing it might have been in Vrindavan, and Maharaj was supposing it might have been in London. But this is recounted in a book by Giriraj Swami called Watering the Seed. And there he says it took place in September 1977 in Juhu, the last time Srila Prabhupada was in the Juhu Iskon temple. So he was quite ill, and devotees were in his room, and they were reminiscing before Srila Prabhupada all the hard struggles of the beginning of the project. And so when it came to this discussion, when Prabhupada used to have to stay with Sri Krishna Kapoor, when it came to this point, then Srila Prabhupada, in a very weak voice, he said, that dog. And the devotees didn't quite know what Prabhupada was referring to. So someone was saying, you mean Mr. Nair, Srila Prabhupada? That dog. And someone else suggested another man. I don't know, Mr. Matar. I don't know who Mr. Matar, but that name is also mentioned. Mr. Matar, that dog. And then it became clear that it was referring to the dog who used to sit next to Srila Prabhupada in Mr. Kapoor's car. I just wanted to mention that. So let's now go on with the seminar today. Today, we're going to be discussing vasana. We're going to be discussing bija, papam, aparabdha karma, kutam and parabdha karma, dukkha, and finally kalpana, imagination. So, vasana. There's a verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, 5.11.5, sa vasanatma visyo parakto saguna pravaho vikrita surishatma bibrat pritan namavi rupavedham antar bahishtvam cha puraish tanot. This means, because the mind is absorbed in desires, vasanas, for pious and impious activities, it is naturally subjected to the transformations of lust and anger. In this way, it becomes attracted to material sense enjoyment. In other words, the mind is conducted by the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. There are 11 senses and 5 material elements, and out of these 16 items, the mind is the chief. Therefore, the mind brings about birth in different types of bodies among demigods, human beings, animals, and birds. When the mind is situated in a higher or lower position, it accepts a higher or lower material body. So, there are 5 considerations I want to unpack from this. The first is that the mind, the material mind, is called here guna pravaha, which means it is conducted by or agitated by the 3 modes of material nature. And each individual's mind is subject to a unique combination of the 3 modes. That's point number 1. Point number 2, that the effect of the modes upon the mind is understood by the mind's constant agitation and restlessness. While consoling his mother as she grieved over the death of Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu nicely summed up this effect in Srimad Bhagavatam 7.2.24. He told her that the soul is always avikala puman, changeless, but when the mind is agitated by the gunas, the soul is bewildered and sees itself undergoing material transformations. In the verse quoted above, this one from the 5th canto, spoken by Jadbharat, so Jadbharat uses the word vikrita to indicate the transformations of mind that are induced by guna pravaha. Is that clear? Material mind means mind which is agitated by the modes of nature. And so, as a result, the mind is restless. And in this restlessness, although the soul is changeless, the restless mind, agitated by the gunas, is bewildered by this material world and sees itself as the body, becomes absorbed in the states of the body, identifies with the body. The pleasures and the pains of the body are this way, tasted by the mind. Okay, so point number 3. Restlessness of mind is fertile soil by which the seeds of desire embedded within the subconscious or karanadeha, that's the lower part of the mind, that we're not aware of. So the seeds of desire which are there, down there, they develop into ideas of sense gratification that blossom in the linga sharira, in our conscious mind, our surface mind. In the Monier-Williams Sanskrit Dictionary, the word vasana is translated as infusing. This is one definition among several. The word infuse means to put into or introduce as if by pouring. Hence the vasanas are waves of desire that pour out of the subconscious into the restless conscious mind. Point number four, the mind is the chief of the 16 material coverings of consciousness. The other are the five gross elements, the five jnanindriyas, and the five karmindriyas. The desires of the mind are served by the 15 other coverings. When the senses engage in satisfying the mind's desires, karma is generated, and the wheel of samsara is turned. Thus the soul takes on body after body according to the mind's condition under the modes, good, mediocre, or bad. I might also mention here that in the translation, where is it? Srila Prabhupada says there are 11 senses and 5 material elements, and out of these 16 items, the mind is the chief. Yes. So we were referring before to the vritti stage of mind, or the material mind is being called vritti, and the pure mind, the original mind, is called tattva. So there are 11 vrittis. Vritti means engagement in Sanskrit. So the material mind has 11 kinds of engagements. And that's with these. It's engaged either in the active senses, the knowledge-acquiring senses, the five sense objects in the form of sight, sound, taste, etc. So that adds up to 15. And then the 16th is abhiman vritti, the mind engaged in itself. We'll be speaking about that more when we come to kalpana, imagination. So abhiman is a synonym for the ahamkara, false ego. So the mind is the situation, is the place where we have our false ego. False ego is a constituent of the mind. Because often the word mind generally means subtle body. Mind also means manasa, one particular function within this subtle body of accepting and rejecting, and that's the place of the emotions and the desires. And then there's the buddhi, the intelligence, which is giving higher knowledge to the mind. And then there's the ahamkara, which is making the mind strongly attached to different things. But altogether, this package of ahamkara, manasa and buddhi are often, we find in Srila Prabhupada's books, just translated as the mind, which is equivalent to linga sharira. So in this sense then, abhimana vritti means when the mind becomes absorbed in itself. And this is speculation, this is kalpana, imagination, this is feelings of pride and all these sorts of things. So this is another vritti. But we'll be coming to that a little later. I just wanted to, since it's referred to in the translation, I just wanted to explain that now. So this is the picture so far. We have our conscious mind, which our surface thoughts are going on. And this mind is guna pravaha, agitated by the modes of nature, the impulses that are coming into the mind from different sources, like the senses and so forth. And the mind is in a state of agitation, and therefore the mind is fertile ground for the vasanas. And the vasanas are desires which pour into the mind from underneath. They can take root in the form of seeds. You see, there's a relationship here. Vasana and bija. Bija is a vasana which has taken root in our thinking. And then the root grows. It goes from thinking to feeling to willing. And willing means we're acting on the desire. And this is how the cycle of birth and death is turning. So, in order to rid the mind of this, then the effect of the modes of nature has to cease. The mind has to stop being guna pravaha. This agitation of mind has to cease. Stita dhirmuni, Sri Krishna uses this term. When the mind is fixed, steady. And also this means, in other words, the mind is no longer in this vritti state, vritti condition, of being always involved with these 11 kinds of engagements. So, therefore the Kali Santaran Upanishad says, iti shodisha kalasya jivasya varana vinashnam tata prakashate parabrahma mega pai ravi rasmi mandali viti. I was citing this in that TV show we did. This is the verse after the other one. Iti shodisha nam nam kali kalma nashnam. That one. Then the next one is iti shodisha kalasya. Yes. So shodisha kalasya, shodisha kal. There are 16 coverings of the soul. Five senses, active senses, five knowledge acquiring senses, five sense objects, 15, and then 16 is the mind itself. This is also here in this verse. Shodashatma. This Bhagavatam verse. Shodashatma. So, iti shorshakala jivasya varanam. Varanam means covering. Vinashanam means destroy. So, the holy name, Hare Krishna Mahamantra, has 16 names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare, 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 Ram, Hare, Ram, 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 Hare, Hare. 16. And this verse says, the 16 names attack and destroy the 16 coverings. Isn't that interesting? And this is like, this means when we chant, then our spiritual power, the power of the Atma, which is of course the gift, the mercy of the Paramatma. You see, the souls who are in this material world, they're very weak, and that is by their wrong desire. Therefore, the Lord has withdrawn their spiritual power. And they have just very meager power, just to be aware of the most, you see, superficial things. So, that power can increase by the grace of the Lord. The example in this verse is of the sun. Ravi, Ravi means sun. Ravi Rashmi Mandali Viti. So, when the sun's rays become very strong, then they burn off the covering of the clouds, which hides the sun from our eyes. So in the same way, when we chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, then the original consciousness, the Krishna consciousness of the soul becomes very strong and burns away these 16 coverings. So, iti shodisha kalasya jivasya varana vinashnam tata prakashante parabrahma. And so in the same way, just like when the clouds are burned away and one can see the sun, so tata prakashante parabrahma. You can understand this. In the same way, one can see Parabrahma and Sri Krishna. In the same way. So this is the solution to this agitated state of the mind, recovering all these sounds, sound effects. Covering my lecture. So, the solution to that is the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So these vashanas are coming into the mind. Now let's, from the subconscious. Now let's look a little more in detail how this results in the suffering condition of the soul. So I'll hold up this diagram here and explain it. Those in the back may not be able to see this so easily. But this is the scheme of the cause of suffering that Srila Rupa Goswami is teaching in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar of Devotion. So you see here, out of avidya, avidya means that primordial ignorance, which we explained yesterday. You see, we have only this very meager surface awareness of things. Most of what we are as spirit soul is covered by ignorance. And so that is all within the subconsciousness. This is again called karana deha, the causal body of primordial ignorance, in which the desires of the soul itself are submerged. They're submerged in ignorance because our desire is cut off from Krishna's devotional service. So these desires are there with no transcendental outlet, so they move in the other direction. They come into our material experience and push us to engage in material activities. So out of this avidya, ignorance, then the vasanas are coming and taking root as bija, as I explained. Bija means the seeds of desire, sinful desires. And bija then is maturing into papam, sinful action. And sinful action is resulting first in aparabdha karma, which means unmanifest reactions. We have in our hearts, those of us here who are materially conditioned, which there's only one of us here who's materially conditioned. All of you are liberated Vaishnavas. So, for my purification, I'm talking to you about my fallen condition. Begging for your mercy. But after you've understood how fallen I am, you'll bless me and raise me up from this hellish state. So, in my heart, there are an unlimited stock of reactions. And as long as one is going on in material life, then these reactions are coming into fruition again and again and again. And because they're unlimited, they're ensuring unlimited births in the future. You see, already what's there is enough for incalculable rebirths. But yet at the same time, in this human form of life, we are adding to that stock by our present pop, our present sinful activities. So, aparabdha karma. Now, what is this? The results of aparabdha karma are going in two directions. One direction is, because this is, as I said, this is a subtle storehouse of sinful reactions. So, rotting away, one might say, inside of oneself. So, this is I'm using figurative language, the odor of this stock of sinful reactions is permeating the mind with what's called kutam, sinful disposition. You see? Just like even a young child who seems to be very naive may seem to spontaneously manifest an attraction for certain kinds of sinful activities. Like even a small boy may have a tendency to steal. You see? Yeah, may become known as a thief. And one thing, how is it He's just a little boy, but already he's practicing thievery. You see. How is that? So this is because of abrupt karma. This is because of the storehouse of sinful reactions lying in potential in the heart. And they are contributing to this kuttam, sinful disposition. That there is an inclination in the mind to engage in sinful activities. It is there, even from before birth, because this is the samsara, this is the endless cycle of birth and death. We are bringing this with us. And then this kuttam, sinful disposition, that is also maturing into bijam, sinful desire again. So sinful desire is coming out of this cycle, this continual cycle, and also coming from ignorance too, in the form of vasana. So in this way, the wheel is turning. By its own energy and by added energy coming from the subconscious. And then I said the aparapta has two effects. So one, yes, as I explained, sinful disposition, and the other is parabdha karma, manifest reactions as suffering. We get body after body, and this body is the dukkhasthanam, the place of our suffering. So this is Srila Rupa Goswami's very clear explanation. You see, I have, in preparing this, I was surfing the internet. I was, because these terms are there, and I was trying to get a better understanding of terms like vasana, papa, bija, aparabdha, so on and so forth. And so I was surfing the internet, and I found a place where Swami Sivananda, who's Tamil, from Malaysia, but he's Tamil family, so he's much respected down here in Tamil Nadu. Swami Sivananda, all of his definitions for these terms are there. And in some way, they were helping me, I think, shedding a little light, but the real clearest and comprehensive and connected, unified understanding comes from Srila Rupa Goswami. So the Vaishnava philosophy is dealing with the same issues that are there in yoga philosophy or Sankhya philosophy, these kind of things, but is giving the most clear and perfect explanation and giving the most clear and perfect solution. So then to go on, yes, we want to talk about kalpana. Kalpana means imagination. So what role does kalpana play in all this? So as I mentioned before, the manas of vritti, the 11 material engagements of the mind, include abhiman vritti, which is false identification and misconception. Srila Prabhupada translates abhiman as misconceptions in Srimad Bhagavatam 5.1.15. An example of misconception is Mayavadi philosophy, which Srila Prabhupada repeatedly argues is rooted in the false ego conception, not the pure spiritual conception. You see, Mayavadi philosophy is ahamkara philosophy. It is extremely refined, rarefied false ego is what it is. The last snare of false ego. One has come up to the mode of goodness in one's spiritual practice. One has detached himself from so many things. You see, one has become learned in the Vedas. But at the end of the day, one is thinking, I am God. You see? Therefore, Mayavadi philosophy, it's interesting. It is the closest thing to Vaishnava philosophy. At the same time, it is the farthest away from Vaishnava philosophy, simultaneously. You see, the Mayavadi sannyasi. When I was in Rameshwaram years ago, visited Rameshwaram in the 1980s with a couple of godbrothers. And you know, there's this big central, it's kind of in the shape of a big square, a square avenue, and I think they have Rath procession in this avenue. We didn't see that, but we saw the cart parked. So it's a huge avenue, very long and broad. And so I was there with two ISKCON devotees, and sometimes we would see on the other end of the avenue, we would see a person or a few persons wearing saffron robes, holding danda, shaved head. And we would think, who are these devotees? And we would go over to them, and as we get closer, we'd see, oh, they're Mayavadi sannyasis. So, even in their appearance, they remind us of devotees, and they speak from the same shastras as we speak. You see, they have Vedanta philosophy, they speak from Bhagavad Gita, they even worship the Lord. Prabhupada cites this injunction from Shankaracharya that Mayavadi sannyasi should install the deities of Radha and Krishna and worship. And I remember seeing one brochure from a Mayavadi sannyasi who was trying to argue. He's saying, these Vaishnavas, they criticize us for having no bhakti. But we are bhaktas. And then he had even a photograph of himself with a bell and incense worshipping deities of Lakshmi Narayan or something like that. With his beard. We are also devotees. And they even go so far as to say, we are better devotees than the Vaishnavas. Because the Vaishnavas, they're still in duality. They're still saying there's something that is not Krishna. But we say everything is Krishna. We are better devotees than they are. So in that sense, it's the closest to us. I mean, Mayavadis are closer to Vaishnava philosophy than the Buddhists, certainly. And anyone else, Jains, or who else do you want to mention? Sikhs, or, you know, anything else you mention is farther away, automatically. So the Mayavad philosophy comes closest. Yet, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Mayavadi hi aparadhi. They are the greatest offenders against the Lord. So, Mayavadi bhashya sunile hoya sarvanash. This is totally destructive to spiritual life if one accepts this Mayavadi bhashya. So anyway, Srila Prabhupada says that the Mayavadi philosophy is not rooted in any spiritual conception, but rooted in the false ego. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya 6.134 states that to interpret Shastra in the Mayavadi manner is Gauna Britti. We may take this Britti also means mental function. So we may take this Britti to be a feature of Abhimana Britti. Gauna Britti, Abhimana Britti, they're compact together. Similarly, Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya 6.134 uses the term Gaunarta Kalpana, for the misconceptions of Mayavad. The word Kalpana means imagination. Kalpana is an acceptable method of knowledge for the Mayavadis, the philosophers of Maya. Srila Prabhupada quotes here, Sarakanam Hityartaya Brahmano Rupa Kalpana. The Mayavadi philosophers, they say that Kalpana, you just imagine any form. He spoke in a lecture in Bhagavad Gita in Bombay. 9 April 1974. So this is part and parcel of Mayavadi philosophy. To imagine that anything is God, anything you want. And therefore we have so many gods in India walking around. He said in Bangladesh, every village. So these are Kalpana Devas, these are gods of the imagination. But that's valid, because Mayavadi philosophy says actually God, he's nirguna, you can't see him, but You can imagine something as God if that will help you come in the end to the nirguna understanding. And they give examples like dreaming of a tiger. One is asleep at night and has a dream of a tiger. Tiger chasing you. So the tiger is not real, that is kalpana, but it is such a ferocious vision that you wake up! Now you're out of mind. You dreamed of the tiger, and that dream helped you wake up. So yes, for you, Krishna can be God. You can imagine like that, if that will wake you up from Maya. Or Durga, or Gadadhar Chattaji, or Vivekananda, or Osho, or Shah Rukh Khan, Aishwarya Rai. Anyone?
Meher Baba.
Huh?
Meher Baba.
This is the Mayavadi process of knowledge. So as a function of Abhimanavritti, the engagement of the mind in false ego, which includes this Gaunavritti, juggling interpretations of the Shastra, taking secondary meanings as mukya, as prominent. Mayavadis imagine themselves to be God and concoct imaginary meanings for the scriptures. So, Mayavadi philosophy aspires to two things: to negate the realities of the human condition in the material world, and two, to propel any ordinary man to the position of God, both by imagination. So now, what time is it? 11 o'clock. I think what we'll do is we'll pause for discussion. I do want to read from something. This is an essay I wrote about the consequences of this kalpana imagination in our modern world. The whole condition of modernity is the result of imagination. So I want to read this, maybe pause here and there to comment, because I feel it's very important to understand how this imaginative feature of the mind can lead to very, very inauspicious results. And we as devotees also have to be very aware of this and to keep a strong control on this kalpana feature of the mind. Otherwise, within our movement, things will develop as they have developed out there. And Bhakti Vikash Maharaj is often telling you that this is what is going on now. It is already happening. So, but right now, let's pause for discussion on the basic tattva that we have been presenting so far. Yes?
Sometimes these terms are defined, vritti, vasana, just like you're quoting Shivananda, they sometimes define them a little differently. That vritti, that's sometimes defined as like the stockpile or the kuta, and that means like the general inclination or the general inclination one has acquired in the course of his karmic peregrinations. Also,
yeah, I do think that these terms, as you can see from the diagram was cyclical. It means one is running into another. So vritti, when we look up in the Moni Williams Sanskrit dictionary, it's translated as occupation or engagement. So manasavritti means mental engagement, occupation, activity of the mind. So then naturally the mind is engaged according to its proclivities. So in that way, yes, vritti and kutam are practically synonyms. But I found this myself. Yes, I found the terms overlap. So that's why I was using Rupa Goswami's his terminology as my core reference, and then trying to bring everything else in line with that. A little bit of anumana on my part. Yes,
Prabhu. What is the difference between samskara and vasana?
Oh, this is a good question too. Actually, yes, I should have talked about samskaras also. In fact, I have a quote. Let me find it. Srila Prabhupada is speaking of samskaras somewhere. I may not be able to find it right now. I remember what he said. So this was in a talk that he gave in a place called Arlington, Texas, in 1972. And some Indians who were living in Texas at that time were in attendance. And one of the Indian gentlemen... here we are. Yes, okay, good. One of the Indian gentlemen is 11th September 1972, Arlington, Texas. One of the Indian gentlemen was raising the question that that your disciples have been able to surrender to you because of samskaras. Meaning, samskaras means they have certain impressions lodged in their minds that have made it inevitable in this lifetime that they will take shelter of you. And he was suggesting by this that others of us may not have those samskaras yet, so therefore we cannot sarvadharmam parityajya right now. So Prabhupada, he replied, well, samskara you can change in a second. Samskara may be powerful. Krishna assures you, aham tvam sarva pape bimokshe shami. He will give you protection. Samskara means you did some sinful activities and you are suffering. But he gives you protection. Sarva pape bhyo. Then what is the meaning of samskara? You can change your samskara immediately by surrendering to Krishna. Why are you so much concerned with samskara? He says, sarva dharma parityajya mamekam sharanam aham tvam sarva pape bhyo moksha. The samskara as effects of sinful activities, that is troublesome. So he gives you protection. Masuchaha. Don't worry. Why don't you take this? You don't want to change your samskara. And who can help you? That is a different thing. You don't want to change. Otherwise, Krishna is ready to give you all help. How their samskara is changed. From the very beginning of their life, he's referring to his disciples. They are addicted to these principles, illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, gambling. How they have changed? They don't touch it. How has it become possible? So, they're very clear. This samskara argument will not stand. He Prabhupada was saying, what are the samskaras of my devotees? My disciples, they were engaged in all sinful activities, but they desired to change by good association. They took good association. And Krishna is guaranteeing, if you want to surrender to me, then I will protect you. There may be so many things lodged in the mind, memories. Because basically what samskara means is memory, an impression, a memory. Just like, again, back to this cycle here. There are some things coming from the subconscious, vasanas, and there are some things coming from the cycle of karma. You see? So some things we have done before, many, many lifetimes before, they are lodged as impressions, and they are appearing as samskara, bija, papam, aparada, kuta, etc. This is another, you see, samskara is just another term that you can use in this cycle instead of bija, perhaps, because samskara means an impression which is stimulating a desire. You see, one has a desire or an inclination to think because of a previous impression already there. So, So in this way, you see, there is this cycle of karma, but there are also things coming from just our primordial state of ignorance. The desires of the living entity, which are not, of course, not engaged in Krishna's service, so they're always bubbling up out of the subconscious. So samskara would specifically refer to things that we have done before, impressions that are lodged in the mind, and they come to the surface again in this life, from previous lifetimes. Anyway, Srila Prabhupada said here clearly that samskaras are not an argument for not surrendering to Krishna. Because Krishna says, I will protect you if you surrender to me. So one must have faith in this. All right? Dharma Setu.
I have two questions actually. The first one is that he said when we for example today's Ekadashi, and if we for example fast on Ekadashi, it is read in the that all our sinful activities are erasing. Everything is just gone immediately. So but still somehow we just going on, you know, in this body, in this same activities we are doing all as usual with that. So it seems that it's somehow there is still some sin in us.
Well, sin will manifest as sinful activity. If one is not performing sinful activities, if one is... Yes, we have this body, but if one is engaging this body only in Krishna conscious activities, devotional service, then this body is what Srila Prabhupada used to call Krishnaized. This is that you sent me, I saw yesterday, this email, this Dugda...
Pato Dugda Nai.
Pato Dagda
Nyaya.
This is the logic of the singed cloth. Again, we mentioned this the other day. That a cloth is brought close to the... Fire is often representing Krishna consciousness. So the cloth representing the body is brought close to the fire. Not close enough that the cloth bursts into flames, but the warp and weave of the cloth is practically consumed by the heat, so that everything is hanging together just very, very slightly. And I said you can easily see this with newspaper. If you light the newspaper, the same thing, the whole page will burn, leaving a single ash. So it looks, and you can even see the type in the ash of the newspaper, the headlines and the typeface, you can still see it there. So the appearance of newspaper is still there, but if you just flick it with one finger, it falls apart. So the body of the devotee who is engaged only in Krishna service is like that. So this is the parabdha karma, the existing karma of this present body. But this cycle that I have shown you, you see, where parabdha, where that's this. This parabdha is this last result. But this cycle that is contributing to more and more and more parabdha, birth after birth, this cycle has stopped. So that means this body is the last body. It goes on as long as it is destined to. But when it stops, that's the end of it. Is that clear?
Just once, if one is doing this, like for example, pass on Ekadashi and do some other activities which are very, very auspicious, is it enough just once to do this? Because it is said that even if one just heard once, all sins are eradicated.
Yeah, well, these sort of statements are, they are presenting what can happen in the most positive circumstances, when everything is very positive and auspicious, then by chanting the holy name just one time, that statement is there, one destroys more sins than one could ever commit. But this is ideal. In other words, such a thing is going to be seen in an ideal person, ideal personality. Like we see Sri Prahlad Maharaj, for example, born in a demon family, born of Hiranyakashipu, his father. Yet, as a 5-year-old boy, he was pure devotee of the Lord, due to having heard, while he was within the womb of his mother, he heard the preaching of Narada Muni. So yes, this can happen. Within the womb of a mother, one hears pure devotee speaking Bhagavata Katha and comes out of the womb as a pure devotee, spontaneously. And even though his father is the biggest demon in the universe and wants his son to be a demon and all kinds of demoniac influence are coming on this boy from all sides, he's a pure devotee nonetheless. And he's so pure that when his father is threatening to kill him, Lord Nrisimhadev personally appears to protect his devotee. So, that's very nice, but I don't think, you know, a grihastha couple who are having, you know, going to have child should expect that their child, you know, we just recite Bhagavatam and it'll come out a Prahlad Maharaj. We may not be up to that ideal standard yet. It's very good to do that, but we shouldn't expect that the same, you know, degree of auspicious result will be seen. It'll be auspicious result, no doubt. So, it, you know, for us it's like the example of the mirror again. Chetu Darpanam Arjanam. So the mirror of the mind must be cleansed. Now, you take your cloth, you go to a mirror or to any glass and you clean it very nicely. You make it sparkling. You see a very clear reflection in it. But if you only do that once, what will the mirror look like, or what will the glass look like after a week or 2 weeks or a month? It will again be opaque, covered. So this cleaning process for us, you remember I mentioned in my talk, about His Holiness Sridhar Maharaj concerning this Nirmala Singhal, this Mataji in Bombay. Prabhupada said to Tamal Krishna Maharaj, you have to learn to be a Vaishnava, but this is spontaneous Vaishnavism. So we are sadhana devotees. We are sadhakas. We are not on this spontaneous rag platform, nor should we ever think. Nor should we think that that is appropriate to us. This is a big mistake. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that the rag and the rag bhaktas, we should serve them as peons. They are, he said, keep them on your head. You see, they are our ideals, not in the sense that we should aspire to become them, but we keep them on our head. We are serving them, and that for us should be enough. You see, unfortunately, one of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's grand disciples, who has come into prominence in recent years, has stated openly in a book called Prabandha Bali that now, although Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has said this, now is a time for us to rise up to this raga platform ourselves. No further comment on that, but we hear from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati that we are peons of the six Goswamis. We are peons of the raga bhaktis and raga bhaktis. And Srila Prabhupada has taught us the same thing. So this is our line. This is our line. So that means sadaka, he's always cleaning the mirror. We chant the holy name, not just one time in great ecstasy, expecting that all sins will be destroyed, but we have to chant every day, 16 rounds. We have to follow the steady program of devotional service, sadhana bhakti, because we are living in Kali Yuga, we are born in these Kali Yuga bodies as denizens of Kali Yuga. This is a contaminated age compared to a dusty atmosphere. So there's always dust falling, constantly. And if we think, yes, one time, clean it off, that means after a while, again, we'll be covered. So this is our duty as sadhakas, keep cleaning. Yes?
How the process of genuine initiation influences this diagram of path? Because devotees is quite often asking about it, how the text, simple reactions go away, and are all the points of the diagram influenced by initiation of this particular, like the taking?
Yeah, well, it says that the spiritual master removes, he takes away the karma of his disciples. Now, how this is done, diksha, is explained by Srila Jiva Goswami. This is cited by Srila Prabhupada in his purport. The word diksha means transmission of transcendental knowledge. So my understanding is it's not simply an external ceremony that removes the karma. Not some devotees, they get some wild ideas. They think that the grains that they throw into the fire are the sins of the disciples. So just throw those grains in the fire, they're all burned up. And then you're liberated. Walk away. A mukta. No. That is ceremony. That also has an importance as a samskara, as creating an impression on the mind that this is to be taken seriously. But the actual thing that burns up this bija, papa, aparada, kutam, etc., that is the fire of transcendental knowledge. This is what Krishna declares in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. That one can be the most sinful of all sinners, but if one is situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, he will also be delivered. The fire of transcendental knowledge burns up any amount of sins. So this is what the spiritual master is giving. And this is the real essence of diksha. So one has to accept initiation in that way. Not just sit in a certain... Like Srila Prabhupada's, one of his very first initiations he gave in New York. So among the initiates was a boy who got the name Karlapati. He was Karl Jurgens. You can read about him in the Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. He helped Prabhupada in the beginning. Then he took initiation. And the way I heard it from Satsarupa Goswami was that evening of his initiation, when he got the name Karlapati, or short, maybe it was not long afterwards, after his initiation, but very close after his initiation, the devotee saw Karlapati with a backpack on his back. Where are you going, Prabhu? Oh, I've decided to go to Greece. What are you going to do there? Well, I always wanted to see Greece. But you just took initiation. Yes, that's the point. I just took initiation, so now I'm free. I'll go to Greece. That's what he said. I just took initiation. Now I can follow that dictum that we heard from Bhakti Vikash Maharaj the other morning. I like it. Now I'm initiated. Now I can truly realize this I like it philosophy. No, then this is again simply one is trying to cheat Krishna. It will not work. Yes?
I cannot understand what do we mean by subconsciousness by the term from where the vasanas are springing up.
Subconsciousness is the storehouse of our desires, and that is wrapped up in primordial ignorance, the very ignorance that covers our awareness of ourself as spirit soul, as eternal servant of Krishna, the very ignorance that is separating us now from Krishna in His service. So this is the, I explained yesterday, depth psychology. Most of the iceberg is below the water. What's above is just our surface awareness right now. Here I am, sitting in this room in Salem, Tamil Nadu. You see, not aware that I have taken birth millions and millions and millions of times in so many different forms, all as a result of these desires that are in the subconscious.
So that refers to that avidya,
yes.
The subconscious.
Yes, the subconscious is... The subconscious means that part of our consciousness which is covered by avidya. And it is also known as the karana deha, that part, which is the causal body. You see, karana deha is the root from which the linga sharira, the mental body, is growing. The mental body is where all the desires are, you know, flourishing. We become aware of our desires in our conscious mind. But the root of those desires, we don't see. You see, we don't... Just like, you know, the old story of love at first sight. You see, here's Joey walking down the street, and from the other side, here comes Lulu. And, you know, they never saw each other before. But suddenly they look at each other, and they hear violins and angels singing. And, you know, they just have to be together from that moment on. Love at first sight. So Joey has walked down the street so many times and he's passed so many girls. And maybe he thought they were, you know, cute, but he didn't really feel this overwhelming attraction. And same with Lulu. She saw so many boys, but this one boy, they, you know, bam! Cupid's arrow strikes the heart. And so this is because of that, what's in the subconscious. You see, so you know, guna pravaha, the mind is in an agitated state all the time. So in a certain circumstance, certain situation of agitation, then a vasana can come up, or a bija from also... Ultimately, how can you distinguish between the two? Really, this is just... I'm just being academic, that's all. We can't really distinguish, but we're just talking about the stock of sinful desires, or material desires, desires to enjoy. So then a vasana comes up, or a bija sprouts, and then it grows up into the mind. We become aware, oh yes, this is the one I love. You see? That particular set of impressions in our mind, this Lulu, you see, her beautiful face, you know, that suddenly has, you know, just becomes overwhelming, because that is there's a reciprocation with a desire, a very powerful primordial desire down in my subconsciousness. So it has come up and manifest and focused on Lulu, you see. So why Lulu? You see, why Lulu? Why not Mary or, you know, Susie? Why only Lulu? So this is the way it works. Specific desire with specific outlet. And you know, and then all of this is, you see, you have to also keep in mind, as we've been hearing about this how the psychology is you can't, our inner state of mind cannot be separated realistically from the greater universe, you see, because of this principle of vyasti samasti. So actually the answer to the question, why Lulu, why this particular girl, you see, that is also the planets. This is where astrology comes in, our destiny, our Daiva has determined by... This is also our past karma. Out there. Governed by the greater forces of the universe. Adi Daiva. So some demigods pulling the strings, they have, you know, arranged that Lulu, this particular girl, with this particular set of lakshanas, qualities, that just, you know, just corresponds to desire as it is in this body now. She comes down the street at this time, 12:03, Thursday afternoon, you know, December 24th, blah, blah, you know, et cetera, et cetera, this year, this time, this place. This is all prearranged. It's all scripted by karma.
So there is such connection between that Vyashti and Samashti means, like, in English, can it be called macrocosm or microcosm?
Macrocosm, microcosm, yeah, that's right. Yes, manager G. I didn't mean to neglect you.
I can't manage some points. Maharaj, can you explain about these karma actions and reactions of pious activities? Sometimes we say that cannot be counteracted, like in story of King Mega, Maharaj is asking, do you want to first enjoy good or suffer bad results? Sometimes we see if you do some pious activity, all things are counteracted. And then Prayashita counteracts something but doesn't neutralize the proclivity. Can you explain how it works, actually?
This is a big question. Well, you know, karma pertains to this body. Actions and reactions, all of that manifest as this body. This body, if you want to know what your karma is, just go look in the mirror. That's your karma. From before, and now as we're acting in this body, we're creating a future karma. And Srila Prabhupada says, when that karma is matured, when you're ready to take the result of the karma that one has done in this lifetime, that's when we are met with death. Then we leave this body. It's the example of the caterpillar crossing from one leaf to another. So first of all, the head of the caterpillar moves onto another leaf, and in this way crosses. This is soul crossing from one body to another. So already while we're on the leaf of this body, we're working on making the next body. So karma is simply the bodies. And mainly that means the subtle body, as we've been saying. So it's a mechanical action, reaction. And this prayaschitta and all that, that is within the realm of karma kanda. Now the difference between karma kanda and karma yoga. Karma yoga is taught by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. So karma, your duties in life. You see, duties, particularly karma is referring, because we've heard there's something called kriya, which means auspicious activities. And there's something called abhas, which are the spiritual discipline, activities of spiritual discipline. So karma, this word, means the more or less ordinary activities of more or less just maintaining the body. Kriya is something different. Abhas is certainly something different. Abhyasa. Abhyasa karma. Abhyasa yoga. So karma means basically like in Varna Ashram Dharma, the karmas of the four ashrams. Basically, they're there to maintain the body. And then, along with that, there are kriyas, there is abhyasa yoga. But there is this basic foundation of maintaining the body. So the karma kandas, the karma kandiyas, they are concerned with using the Vedic scriptures for karmic purposes. Karma yogis, they are offering their karma to the Lord. It's a different thing. Karma kandiyas are opportunists. They think, well, if I observe this, like in South India, you have this Vaikuntha Ekadashi. So in other words, if one day a year I become a Vaishnava, one day a year I put on the Urdrapunda and go to the Vishnu temple because of Vaikuntha Ekadasi, then this will be very good for my business. So this is the Karmakanda approach. And you know, one can discuss whether there is some, you know, any sort of effect or, you know, result that comes from this, but that discussion is not important because ultimately the whole thing is just cheating. What Krishna wants, Krishna doesn't speak Bhagavad Gita to help Mr. Patel in his business. That's not why Krishna spoke Gita to Arjuna. Krishna is asking us to surrender to him. You see? So if someone wants to use Gita or, you know, the Lord for his karmic purposes, that's cheating. And he will be cheated. Of course, Prabhupada always said it's better to approach the Lord. It's better to approach the Lord than to be an atheist. But it means, if you approach the Lord and try to cheat him, it means he will cheat you. Otherwise, if you're just an atheist, then Maya will cheat you. So it's better to be cheated by Krishna back. Because he will cheat you to eventually surrender to him. You see, but it will be a hard way, probably. You see. Just like also Prabhupada explains about great demons like Ravana, who are great devotees of Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva is the greatest Vaishnava of all. So they pray to Lord Shiva for all kinds of power. He makes them so powerful that only Krishna can kill them. So Lord Shiva cheats them to be killed by Krishna. So that when they die, they're seeing Krishna or Lord Ramachandra before them. And so that is very good for them spiritually. Otherwise they have, you know, a demon, such an asura, like Hiranyakashipu or Ravana, these Brahma Shiva, also Brahma is doing the same thing, Brahma Dev. So they would not die seeing Krishna face to face. So this is an example of how the Lord cheats back these rascals who try to cheat him. But better thing is to follow Gita as Gita is, Bhagavad Gita as it is. Not as we are, Prabhupada said. And so in Gita, we're advised to begin. You begin Karma Yoga, like earlier in the Gita, Krishna is presenting Arjuna arguments from Karma Yoga, that whatever you do, yat karoshi, yarashnashi, whatever you eat, whatever you offer, whatever you give, do that all for me. You see? And just by doing that under Krishna's direction, that is already the start of bhakti. There's not a contradiction if we're following Krishna's direction between karma yoga and bhakti yoga. It's simply a development of bhakti. That our bhakti begins on this platform, that I'm living outside, I have my job, I have my family, it would be irresponsible to immediately give that up. So I just offer all this. Manasa deho geho gyo kichumor, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur prays in that. I just offer everything in my present life to Krishna, to his service. So that's Karma Yoga. And this is the real way to get free of sinful reactions, to get free of karma. You offer the results. And Krishna says clearly, if you do that, offering the fruit of karma to me, then one will not have to take birth here again. And anything else is just cheating. Yes.
I was asking this question also in the morning, but about endeavor and karma. There's some very influential people in the world, like very rich people. And is there also a place for endeavor for accumulating their wealth, or is it just the results of their past activities?
Oh, this question that you wrote me about. Yes. The question is, in different Shastric quotes, we find an indication that whatever is coming to one is deserved by what one has done before. And then on the other side, there is indication, like it is told about the lion is king of beasts, but still he has to go out and hunt his food. So So one has to endeavor. But there is no contradiction between these two. This again is, this I mentioned the other day about how particularly Western people, their thinking falls into these rigid categories. And they see, you know, they will see like the one Shastric statement as being contradictory to the other. And that's why Western scholars, they say, we can't accept this Bhagavad Gita because it is full of contradictions. It seems in one place it's saying this, another place. Well, why is it contradictory? Because Krishna says in the Gita in the third chapter that you have to act. You can't live in this body without performing karma, without performing activity. Karma, in its basic meaning, just means action. And so the Bhagavatam explains that, sixth canto of Bhagavatam, that Dehindriya Dehindriya prana manastiyumi. Yes, Dehindriya prana manastiyumi. Yadangsa vritta. Yadangsa vritta. Prachanti karmashu. So, the impetus for the karma, and what is the karma involved? The karma involves deha, the body, indriya, the senses, prana, the life airs, mana, the mind, di means intelligence. So these are all material elements. And that's what's undergoing karma. But the impetus for that karma, the ultimate stimulating force, the energy of that karma, is the amsa of Brahman, which is within the body in the form of Atma Paramatma. So because, you see, there's a difference between our Vaishnava philosophy and the Mayavad philosophy. Vaishnava philosophy is saying that that spirit is dynamic. Spirit is active. You see, the fullest realization of the spiritual state is lila, divine pastimes of the Lord, not impersonal, inactive, insentient Brahman. That's the Mayavadi idea, that the ultimate realization of spirituality is no form, nirakar, arup, and no activity. It's just, you're just there, that's all. So therefore, these elements that are actually doing the karma are energized from the spiritual dimension, from within the heart. So there must be karma. You have to act. You cannot stop activity. So, and by the previous karma, yes, there is what's called daiva or adrishta. Adrishta karma means unseen reactions, this or aparabdha. And they're in store and they will come to us. They will come to us, yes, but still we have to act. You see? And how do you act? You act according to your nature. So, person has a nature to be a businessman, so he does his work as a businessman. And he should do his work with full enthusiasm. He should work. And then if there is something stored up for him, that by his business he will get $1 million, that will come to him. You see? And also it's not, again to use this Latin phrase, necessarily quid pro quo. It's not, there may just may be some ordinary Joey. Joey and Lulu. Now they got married. And but Joey's not so, you know, he's not so good in business. He's just a very simple guy. and just kind of struggling along. But then suddenly he finds out that grandfather died, and grandfather had hidden away a vast amount of wealth and left it to him in his testament, his will. So this is the same thing. But still Joey's working. Still there's activity. So Daiva Netrina. This is in the Bhagavatam. The Karmana Daiva Netrina. Jantu Deho Upadyate. Yes. So one is receiving a body due to one's karma, but under the supervision of the Supreme Lord. And that supervising power is called Daiva, and another translation for Daiva is destiny. So in fact, you see, if we consider that we have this aparabdha karma, we have an unlimited stock of reactions already, enough to keep us in this material world to the figurative end of time, which never ends. Then there's a question, then according to what schedule are these reactions coming due? You see? That means there are reactions there that will result in me sitting in Indralok, on the throne of Indra. There are reactions that will result in me crawling on the bottom of the ocean with eight legs, claws, clacking my claws. There are reactions that will have me flying in the sky as a bird. There are reactions that will have me under the ground as a worm. You see, all of these are there. So according to what schedule do these reactions come due? That is under the supervision of the Lord. So ultimately it's up to Krishna. We always say that. And it's scientific fact. So many reactions are there. So it is Krishna who is indicating. Prabhupada said like that. Prabhupada said like that. He's in the heart and Prakriti is in the heart, along with the jiva. He is there and his Vishnu Maya is there. Paramatma and Vishnu Maya are also in this heart with us as Jiva Atma, and the Lord as Shakshi, as witness, is observing us, observing our desires, and then he's indicating to Prakriti that now he wants to be a dog, so give him the body of a dog. So under the supervision of the Lord, we are getting these different bodies.
It means that actually there is no suffering in living, because we're forced to act if we're in the material nature. But endeavor should mean that it is something like above the, you know, material nature. Because we are forced to act when we are in material nature.
Yes.
And there is no endeavor actually.
And there is no endeavor.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Like, you know, some very, if your karma allows, you will get the result. But anyway, if you're like really working hard, there is no karma, you know, like positive somehow, just coming, then you can't get it.
Well, that is true. I mean, it's true in the sense that one may work hard for aims, but those aims are not being permitted by the Lord. Those results are not being allowed by Him. He's not allowing them to come due. So, still one will work. That's the point. And sometimes they come due, and sometimes they don't. So there is a logic of work to result. There is. There is, because unless someone is very, very sinful, you see, anyway, in all cases, God is our kind Father. And He's put us in this world. Also, this is His mercy, you see. Now someone may be very, very sinful, so then their whole life is a big mess. And whatever they do, nothing comes out right. So what lesson should he learn from that? Just surrender to Krishna. Actually, everyone, we should all surrender to Krishna. But even a seemingly very unfortunate person, you see, that's what his misfortune is. That's the logic of his misfortune, that he should surrender to Krishna. hypocrisy. So Krishna is kind to all, and what he really wants is that we surrender to him. And those who don't want to surrender, those who, you know, and those who have some desire still to enact in this world, then Krishna is also giving that facility, all right. You can work and you'll get some result. So Krishna is kind. So one should not be, you know, overly skeptical in regards to Krishna and his arrangements. This is another problem, the skeptical kind of thinking, that if it's like this, then what's the use of doing anything?
You have to act anyway.
You have to act anyway. And Lord has arranged everything. And he, you know, these varnas in which one is acting, they're all given by the Lord. And the Lord is kind to us, so even in material affairs, one should expect that he's going to give us at least what we need. Prabhupada always said, the elephant eats hundreds of pounds a day, the ant needs only very little. God is providing to all, so why should we? This is also Christ's preaching in the New Testament. Consider the lilies of the field, consider the birds. They're getting what they need. So why should we be in anxiety? This anxiety is due to our ignorance. So one should become aware of the presence of the Lord as the background. Dive in itrena, observing everything we're doing. And depend on him. Yes?
What
did you get?
What is it with those people who had the unnatural way of death? I mean, if they are killed or they die in some accident, does it mean that they also had prepared their future body? And they just have this kind of terrible death because of their past sinful activities? Or how does it work? I mean, they don't die
for
too long, I mean, you know, old age or...
Yeah, well, if it's simply karma, then that is sinful reaction. If it's simply karma. But the Lord may suddenly take his devotee out of this world by any way the Lord chooses. The Lord may desire just to take a devotee back home right away and arranges something that appears to, you know, materially conditioned persons to be a tragic accident. So we have to see, we have to determine the connection to Krishna. Devotee's death, if he's a devotee, it's always auspicious. But in the field of karma, then there's, you know, shubha, ashubha. There's what's conventionally considered nice. So that means to live a good long life. You see, die at age 108, surrounded by relatives, and, you know, everyone saying, this was a great person, did so much for us in life. But, you know, you look at the Bhagavatam, this is also not really auspicious either. But conventionally, people take it that way. And if someone dies young in a terrible accident or, you know, some violent death like that, that's considered ashubha, inauspicious. Yeah. Yes, Dharma Setu again.
Can we say that this svabhava or this subconscious is equal to our nature, or what is the actual nature by definition?
Yeah, you know, svabhava means nature, and svabhava is Prabhupada. He used this as an equivalent for that word intuition. Prabhupada didn't very much like this word intuition, so he explained what they call intuition. Prabhupada explained in Vedic terms with the word svabhava, which means the innate nature one has. One is born with a certain nature from previous karma, and one is reminded of this nature by the Lord within the heart, that you have taken birth due to these desires which in your past life you were hankering to fulfill. So now those desires have brought you to this life, And here you are. He reminds you. So that is Svabhava. Yes, you haven't asked yet.
He once wants to offer fruits of his activities to the Lord, but his activities are sinful. For example, he produces alcohol. That he must give up his job, or he can give, for example, money to the temple or something like that. What he must do?
Well, they can and do give to the temple, particularly in India. They go to Tirupati and they give a big donation and a hundi. But that's not following Bhagavad Gita, exactly. That is something that is showing the some intention to serve the Lord. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying to give up those sinful activities and surrender to Him. So if one wants to, you see, one can get some kind of mercy, but it is materialized mercy from that. One is, you see, a person who's, the mentality of a person who's going on with such sinful activities, but making a contribution to the Lord in some way, is that he's looking for a material result. That's why he's going about his affairs like that. He's very attached to his material life and doesn't want to give it up. But he has enough piety to understand that it's good in the material sense. He feels some guilt. You see, I'm a brewer. I'm Patel Breweries or whatever. So Mr. Patel feels some guilt. So to relieve of himself of the guilt, he'll give a donation to Lord Srinivas at Tirupati once a year. And so he may get some nice result from that, but materially speaking. And that actually, what we can expect is that he'll run into trouble. He doesn't want that, but eventually, this is how the Lord will deal with him. The Lord will wait. Let him do enough of that type of service, and then the Lord will bring down the hammer. All right, now you have been trying to serve me, but now we want to see, are you really my devotee or not? You see. But that may take some time.
This kind of helping is karma yoga or karma kanda? If he gives money to the Lord.
Well, if he's steady, if he's steadily doing that, then that is the beginning of karma yoga. Because yoga means steady practice. Karma kanda means sheer opportunism. That just here's a chance. One is calculating, I want to get a certain result, so which god shall I worship? And, Vaikuntha Ekadasi is coming up, so let me worship Vishnu. It's a good day to worship Vishnu, Vaikuntha Ekadasi, on the calendar, it's just now coming. If it's another time of the year, then Shivaratri, okay, we'll worship Lord Shiva. You see? Opportunism. Yes?
Can you explain this actually, what's the definition of karma yoga loga moha? Because these six enemies are actually, is it desire or?
Actually, a lot of these questions are really going off the subject of the seminar.
In relation with desires, with the simple desires, this is like karma. We have problems. This is the enemy which is actually giving us the most problems. Is it desire with karma or how we can define this, the term?
Karma means desire, yeah. Oh, I haven't understood what... That's a fact. Karma means desire, okay? Is that what you want to know?
Yeah.
All right. It sounded very complicated.
Asking how karma, krodha, loga all fits into the pattern.
Yeah. Oh, now you. All right. Just has brought out the complication.
It's your destiny.
Yeah, it's true. Well, anger, greed, lust as sex desire. This is all coming up against the general background of calm as just general desire. These are specific designations of different ways that desire comes out in our consciousness. Frustrated desire comes out as anger. And yes, desire comes out, sexual desire comes out. Greed, just different manifestations of base calm as basic desire. Can we go on? I wanted to talk more about kalpana. So, as we've heard, Mayavadi philosophy is arising out of kalpana, and the modern culture of the world is a manifestation of Mayavadi philosophy. Therefore, in our prayers for Srila Prabhupada, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, he's gone to the lands where Nirvishesha Shunyavad philosophy are predominant, the Western countries. Now, in the Western world, it's not the Mayavad, the classical Mayavad of Adi Shankaracharya that is predominating, but it is still the same principles I've mentioned here. This idea out of imagination that the miseries of the world can be negated by an adjustment of the mind. And the other thing is that an ordinary man can become God. So that philosophy is, one can say that is the philosophy of the modern world. And so I want to help you understand this in historical terms. So Maharaj has conveniently lit the path of this presentation in a previous lecture where he was mentioning the enlightenment. The enlightenment. Now, that is a particular period of European philosophy, particularly in France in the 1600s and first part of the 1700s. There were a number of thinkers known as the, in French, philosophes, which means philosopher, but particularly means more something like intellectual, persons who are very, who are much engaged in philosophizing about everything. And so they propose that a European civilization should be set on a completely rational basis. And these men were largely of an atheistic bent of mind. They did not think that European civilization could be helped by being under the Christian thumb. They thought that people should break away from that. But they were proposing more or less like a very systematic alternative to Christian doctrine in terms of the science of that time, encyclopedic knowledge. This was a time when encyclopedias first started to be compiled during the Enlightenment to explain everything rationally. And they thought, this is why it's called the Enlightenment. They thought they were bringing light to the people, bringing them out of the darkness of superstition and blind faith and seeing the world as it is and understanding the real laws of the world, and then in that way you work and society will get better and better and better. So this trend went on until there was a reaction to the Enlightenment in the form of Romanticism. And the founder acharya of Romanticism is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who is a Swiss Frenchman from Geneva. And he was the first, well, in recent, you know, centuries, he is the archetypical hippie. You see? So Rousseau's philosophy has all these elements of, you know, idealizing the noble savage. This was a reaction against all this intellectualism, scientism, just like we saw. When I grew up in the United States, I was born in 1950. So, through the 1950s up till the middle 60s, America was very, you know, I remember from the school, everything very much geared to science. Science and learning and the space program and, you know, all of these things. Putting man on the moon. But it reached a crisis point. They reached a point where that's, for my generation, you know, we just couldn't take anymore. It was just too much pressure in school, too much pressure to conform to this very rigid, you know, very, you know, black-white definitions. Everyone, you know, everyone work within the system, you know. And so we just had enough, and we decided to break free of this, become noble savages. Noble savage meaning a person who rejects all the rigidity of urban civilization, kind of goes back to nature and rediscovers the noble original principles of the free human being. And so this Rousseau coined the slogan, "To thine own self be true." And so many other things. And, you know, at the same time, Rousseau was a total, I mean, he spoke of noble savage, but he was one of the really very immoral persons of history. He fathered in different women a number of, I think, at least half a dozen illegitimate children, which he didn't take care of. Some of them died of neglect because he wouldn't give them money. He was like that, you know, you just flow through life. And, okay, you know, here you have a relationship with this woman until it, you know, you just don't like it anymore. You just flow on. And there she is with the baby. But wait a minute. Oh no, I have to my own self, I must be true. So, Rousseau, you see, these Enlightenment philosophers, they were philosophers of the intellect and of reason and also pratyaksha, you see. What's out there concretely, objectively, and then we take that and run it through very systematic reason and come up with a scientific explanation. But Rousseau is a philosopher of the imagination. Like, this is what is predominating the world, actually. Science is also there, but Rousseau and the Enlightenment philosophers, they added something that captured the emotional side. And what did I tell you yesterday? That actually we are ruled by emotions. And the romantic philosophers, they elevated emotions to they actually acknowledge the real role of emotions, that beyond intellect and beyond activities, you know, beyond thinking and beyond action, above and beyond, there are the emotions, and that's the real place where things are to be determined. But they did all this by imagination. So what is that? What is the result of emoting imaginatively? It's called sentimentalism. You see? A sentimental person is someone who just, you know, for anything and everything, he has all kinds of emotions. It's not directed, it's not channeled. He just let the emotions run free. So this is romanticism. And so this is actually the predominating philosophy of the Western world. Not to say that science isn't also powerful, but science is underneath romanticism. Science is operating beneath. We find Robert Kennedy, the younger Kennedy brother. I've seen this slogan in Catholic churches. When we used to do Sankirtan, sometimes we'd stay. We'd visit the church rectories where the fathers of the church would live. And we'd get a room from them. And they'd put us in some room which they would use for, extra activities, which they normally could afford to give us, because maybe only on one day of the week they would use this room for receiving guests or something. And I remember seeing several times on the wall, you see a picture of this Kennedy brother, and the slogan was, some people dream dreams and ask why. I dream dreams and ask why not. Now this is a succinct expression of romantic philosophy. Why not? And the aim of this romantic philosophy, by imagination, is to elevate man to the status of God. And very much in this romanticism is this egalitarianism, which we heard about. Everyone should be equal, because everyone is God. Everyone is a noble savage. Everyone should be true unto themselves. And society should simply facilitate individualism as much as possible. But to facilitate individualism, you see, this is the iron fist beneath the velvet glove. To facilitate individualism, anything that opposes, you see, the predominant idea of what individualism is, that has to be suppressed ruthlessly. And so therefore you'll find that in Rousseau's writings also. He was a total rabid fanatic against anyone who disagreed with him. And therefore the other philosophers of his time, you see, Rousseau, he introduced something new. It was a kind of a fresh breeze, they thought. Turned out to be the aroma of something else, actually. But initially they thought it was a very fresh breeze into the, you know, the musty, dusty, encyclopedic, hallways of academic learning. And here's this fellow, you know, who's advocating free thought and free love and individualism and be true to yourself, and people should, you know, be liberated from conventions. And so other philosophers of his time, they thought, oh, this is very nice. You know, this is what I mean. It's very influential. But as they got to know Rousseau beyond his ideas, they got to know this person. Then you can read in their writings, you know, after he would come and stay with them, actually. You know, they first would read what he wrote, and thought, this is very nice. Like this Scottish, I mentioned him, David Hume. So Rousseau went to live with him for a while, because David Hume read his stuff and thought, this is good. So come, let's talk. But wherever he would go and actually meet another philosopher, he would leave a very negative impression in that flood. So you find such statements as, this man is a madman, this Rousseau, he's a monster, he's depraved, he's insane. All the different philosophers of Europe who had met him, they were, after meeting him, they dismissed him as a crazy man. And so Rousseau, his romantic ideology is sort of the garden from which things like communism, socialism, and modernism, the modern doctrine of now, which is also this apparent individualism, very much stressing individual rights, rights of minorities, and all this sort of thing. But the what's behind it all is a very harshly dogmatic and very limiting definition of what individualism is. You see? So, yeah, noble savage. An individual should be a primitive. Individualism means a person who has no hang-ups about giving vent to his most primitive urges. And this is what society should facilitate. You see? So, you know, just like I saw this on the internet, that there was some, what are called the Grammy Awards, just a month ago or so. Grammy is an award given to musicians. And all these musicians are clones of Rousseau. And so Michael Jackson's sister, Janet Jackson, she came on, this is nationally, actually worldwide broadcast, because it's the world music, Western world music business. So even I think in India they can watch this, certainly on satellite TV. So she was on this, you know, world TV and singing some song with a boy singer too, a young man, young girl, young man, singing together the song. And then they had planned this. They hadn't told the producers of the show, but they had planned, and they did this. At the end of the show, he pulled off the top part of her dress, exposing her breasts, you see, to the camera, so the whole world could see this. And then, you know, there was a big outcry, and the government said, we can't allow this. But then, of course, you know, then the Civil Liberties Union, all these groups, we can't suppress freedom of expression. We can't go too far of this. Maybe many people didn't like this, but after all, they were performers and they were expressing themselves. So we cannot allow censorship. Censorship is very bad. See? So this is what this romanticism has brought. It is what to say. It is mass stupidity, full of all kinds of contradictions, and very much because it is so emotional, so ruled by emotional states. So the values are decided by the mood of the moment. That's the main thing. The mood of the moment, what has fired everyone's imagination, that becomes the truth in capitals. The truth. And everyone should follow it. And if you're not following it, then there's something wrong with you. And you must be, yes, you must be crushed. You must be locked up. So, this is all arising from kalpana, imagination. Therefore, nirvishesha shunyavadi. The Western worlds are the land of that. Nirvishesha shunyavadi philosophy is arising from kalpana, and this both enlightenment and the romanticism which came afterwards and swallowed the enlightenment with uncontrolled emotionalism. This is all arising out of an unrestricted imagination. So now, that's not to say that there's no role for the imagination at all. That this is, I wanted to mention in our talks about the mind, especially what we were talking about yesterday, hearing Srila Prabhupada saying that you remember all of one's desires, this whole manifestation of the stockpile of desires and the whole cosmic manifestation with the example of Krishna looking in Mother Yashoda's mouth. Because what is here in this body is just a replica of the whole universe. So all of this can, Srila Prabhupada was saying, can be revealed within the mind when one achieves the Vasudeva Sattva platform. So in goodness, in pure goodness, yes, the imagination does have its function too. And we use an imagination in Krishna consciousness, for example, to understand this philosophy. These questions you're asking, you're using your mind in a sort of imaginative manner to think of different scenarios, think of different arguments that might be, well, Maharaj has said this, but what if that? This is use of imagination. So it's not like, yes, I was thinking Acharya Raj, when he was known as Acharya Rajneesh, before he became Bhagavan Rajneesh and before he became Osho, Acharya Sri Rajneesh, he had his ashram in Pune. And I think there still is an ashram there. But when he was there personally, when that was his own peat, as they say. Avidya peat. Then there was a sign he kept at the gate, at the entrance to the ashram, with inverted commas, ashram. And the sign said, shoes and minds must be left at the gate. Now, of course, for a philosophy like that, that is required. In order to accept Rajneesh's philosophy, one does have to leave one's mind at the gate. But this is not Vaishnava philosophy. We don't say that the mind is the creation of the devil. We already explained this. We're not dualistic theologians that say the mind is Satan and therefore must be banished. We don't say the imagination is Satan. But the imagination is dangerous, extremely dangerous, if it is not properly directed by Sarvashastra Guru. And that's what's, you know, I think that that's a valid analysis, that there are certain trends, even in our own ISKCON Sangha, which are the result of imagination that is allowed to just run free. Imagination with its, you know, emotions and all of that just allowed to run free. And again, you know, the what's at the bottom of the whole thing is this Mayavadi philosophy. When imagination is allowed to run free, then it immediately starts to concoct the principles of Mayavadi philosophy. That we can be liberated by imagination, by negation. You know, in other words, by our own will, by our own opinion, I can declare myself, I'm free, I'm independent. You remember, you know, those who are old enough, old devotees, we remember 1976 in America, the 200th anniversary of, because America won its freedom from Great Britain in 1776. So in 1976 they celebrated 200 years of independence. But the Back to Godhead magazine that was published for July 4th is the actual date of that independence. The title, lead title was, on the cover, was Declaring Our Dependence Upon Krishna. And Prabhupada, his article was saying there is no question of independence. Nobody is independent. This is what? This is the imagination. This is the essence of this Maya Kalpana, this illusory imagination. That I think that I'm independent. This is where, you know, that's the locus standi of that idea, is this kalpana, imagination. So Mayavadi philosophy is a philosophy, and you know, elaborate, seemingly based on the Vedas, philosophy of the independence of the soul. But the soul is God. God is the supreme independent. So if I become God, then I'm independent. That's what they want. And this, all these Western values, it's the same thing, based on the same misconception. That we are independent. That we determine reality. You know, reality is something determined by us, by what we think, by our imagination. So it's 12:19. We have 10 more minutes before the official close of today's seminar. So again, we can have some discussion on these issues. Yes?
I was thinking that what is the difference between the Kalpa and just contaminated intelligence? Because intelligence also is...
Well, kalpana is, you know, kalpana is part and parcel of intelligence. It is a kind of function of the intelligence along with the mind. It is a function of the subtle body. Kalpana, I think, best to say it's a function. But intelligence is certainly involved in the function, as is the mind too. And certainly the false ego, when we consider this, you know, romantic style of kalpana or Mayavadi style. So what is it? It is the function. Nice, Mark.
Now, the modern world view, which is, I mean, it's a very broad term. You're saying it's based on kalpana, but then it seems to mix, right? the empiric approach. They'll study, they'll make studies, ultimately they come back. Whatever their studies are, they have to apply some imagine. Prabhupada said that. What is that? They hypothesize, they experiment, and then they talk all nonsense. But it's, even with all their studies, the studies, you're saying the Occam's razor, it should come to the point of Krishna, but instead they just use their imagination to avoid.
Yeah.
Krishna, despite all the study of science, should lead to Krishna. They should see God. If not Krishna, at least they should see God.
This is that principle that Jhuta Karma and Sariputta Prabhu's, in their book Forbidden Archaeology, they use this term knowledge filter. The knowledge filter is kalpana, imagination. This is how it's working. That all this evidence is there, paleontological evidence, geological evidence, archaeological evidence. So much evidence is there, but it's filtered according to what? According to an imaginary doctrine called Darwinism. So yes, there's, you know, pratyaksha coming in, but one has to sort through it. According to what? According to kalpana, imagination. Now, this doesn't fit the theory. Stick it in the storeroom and lock the door. Bury it. Don't let the public know about this. There's one American researcher. I mean, he's dead now, but his name is Charles Fort. And in the 1920s and 30s, maybe a little in the 40s, he did a great deal of research in the Metropolitan Library of New York City and also in the London libraries. He researched all the scientific journals. I mean, the journals that are published by scientists, for scientists, and not meant for public consumption. And he compiled three books which have been put together in one volume, a big, thick volume of this, what is called anomalous scientific findings that you don't hear about. And for example, to tell you, you'll find this very interesting. So he found in three separate countries, Germany, Holland, and England, reports from observatories in three different countries over a period of several years. This was at the end of the 1800s, like 1890, something like that. So in three separate European countries, astronomers looking out of their telescopes into the night sky at the moon, they observed what appeared to be to them, this is what they wrote, this is what was put in the astronomical journal, that they saw something that appeared to be a gigantic bird. One measurement was wingspan of 400 kilometers and the length of the body of 250 kilometers. A gigantic bird flying across the face of the moon. And in one case, one astronomer saw it land on the moon. They just saw this black silhouette of the bird. They couldn't see features. Now in the Bhagavatam, of course, we have information of the Sena eagles that fly between planets and lay their eggs in the space. And by falling, the eggs heat up and hatch. And the Prabhupada writes about this. And, you know, we may have, if one has been sufficiently brainwashed by modern science, one may doubt such descriptions. Sometimes devotees have privately asked me about that. How to understand this? But there have been reports from astronomers that substantiate this. But you never hear about them. Because they do not fit the approved imagination of what's going on in this world. So it's just, you know, I don't even know. It doesn't even seem they even bothered to try to explain what this was. They just hid it away. These different astronomers, three different countries saw it, but, you know, all right, put it in the journal, fine, and just stick it in the back room and make sure the padlock is on the door.
It's that magazine you get, isn't it?
14 times.
Yeah. Charles Fort.
Yes. Yeah, this is a British magazine inspired by the work of Charles Fort. And he's got all kinds of things in his, you know, all kinds of things, incredible things. Repeatedly through, there have been reports by good, you know, trustworthy observers of seeing in the night sky titanic battles being fought by gigantic personalities riding on horseback with swords and spears, armies clashing in the sky. And this has been seen, you know, not just once, but repeatedly through the ages by persons in those, you know, in those times and places that were considered very reputable persons, not just drunk, you know, the town drunk, but, you know, the mayor of a village, or, you know, the mayor and the parson, and, you know, those persons who were considered very learned and respectable, they would report seeing such things. So all kinds of things are observed in this world. You know, we're going to talk about pratyaksha. So all kinds of things are observed even in recent times, which a devotee would know immediately how to match up to the statements of the Vedas. But but this is all locked away. No one should know about it. Yes? You have 2 minutes.
Can you elaborate on this point that by pure intelligence we can see the soul? Actually, it is said, Prabhupada said in his books.
Pure intelligence, you can see the soul, yes. This is the same thing, the clean mirror of the mind. Pure intelligence in Lord Kapila Dev, Shiksha, in third canto. There's a verse there that says intelligence is inseparable from the soul. So pure intelligence simply means the consciousness of the soul, because the soul is chit shakti, a particle of chit shakti, which means the energy of consciousness or the energy of chetana, awareness, intelligent. The soul is intelligent in its own original nature. So pure consciousness means, pure intelligence means pure consciousness. Pure consciousness means self-realization. Realization, aham brahmasmi. That's what it means. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says when the mind becomes clean, then, yeah, that is the mind, pure consciousness then. The mirror of consciousness by which we can actually see the pure self, the Atma, and also the Lord, side by side.
Hare Krishna
Bhakti Vikas Maharaj ki jai.